This is the Partially Examined Life, episode 393, part two. Still discussing Hegel's essay, Faith and Knowledge, although we spent the entirety of part one talking about the Kant sections from the Critique of Judgment.
I have a segue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because Kant is talking about, I think we had some trouble understanding identity of opposites, right? And that's right there in this Critique of Kant. But in a way, that's what Kant is talking about for the intuitive archetypal intellect, God's intellect. He's saying that universal or concept in particular converge there. There's no, in a way, difference between the intuition and the understanding. There's no given that the understanding then processes. In a way, the act of intellectual intuition creates what it intuits. So just as those two faculties kind of collapse into each other, we can think of the intelligible substrate of the world, the thing in itself, as having this collapse of universal into particular. And then the two will emerge out of that. So it's not this picture where you have understandings with concepts and then particulars get thrown at them and the particulars get subsumed under the concepts and all that. It is some primordial reality in which both emerge at the same time, both concept and particular. Or you can, let's say, universal to keep it ontologically uncommitted. But yeah.
So I guess this is the same thing we had in starting our Hegel's Critique of Kant. Hegel had pointed at Kant's, this primordial synthesis of the manifold, right? How the intellect gets created according to Kant, right? That you've got your sensibility, which is getting some data, which has to be from the thing in itself in some way, right? Where else could it come from? It's not creating it by itself. And then bringing the concepts of the mind that organizes the data. So if I get a wash of color and I bring in not only the a priori concepts that it's a substance, it is in the forms of sensibility, it is in space and time, but also the ordinary concepts like dog, so that I end up calling this particular splash of brown color a dog. Okay, I've done that. There's a bunch of synthesizing that's been done there. And the question is, what is doing the synthesizing? Like, so for Kant, okay, well, there's an I that has to accompany all perceptions and they make them all mine. But we can't say anything else about it. It's a transcendental ego. It's just a bare nothing. But for Hegel, like, no, this is actually, run with this, Kant. You've actually just posited this sort of super being that is able to collapse the data and the forms together to make experience. Why not just associate this? You know, so he says on 393, philosophy does not go on from judgment to a priori inference from the acknowledgement that the judgment is the appearing of the in itself to the cognition of the in itself. So just say, you know, hey, this is philosophy saying what the in itself, what the really God ends up being. It is the thing that is doing the synthesizing. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think, right. So in Kant, it's the imagination. There's something called the synthesis of the imagination.
Yeah.
And a lot of the work it has to do is because of time, the problem of time. So when we perceive something, we don't even get a perception without some gathering up over time and holding together. In a way, memory is implicated. And so the imagination has to do some work, even for us to get particulars. And Kant has this whole thing of how, you know, how does sensibility and understanding, how do those two things cooperate and fit together? And you get this picture of the synthesis of the imagination kind of like dipping its fingers down into sensibility and kind of kneading the dough a little bit to make the particulars susceptible to the concepts and all this stuff. So I think for Hegel wants to ontologize the imagination. And we can do that with this picture of the intuitive archetypal intellect that in a way produces its own given. So you ontologize the imagination and you say, well, this is really a picture of a process by which, you know, it's the world that synthesizes itself. Let's put it that way. The world holds itself together over time. And you can imagine that ontology on analogy to a cognition. And maybe, and that is kind of the way we have to imagine that, because cognition and the world fit together in this important way.
Yeah, That's a great point, Wes. The language that Hegel uses in Faith and Knowledge, here I'll read from page 76. There's some lead up to this, but I don't think we want to rehash all the Hegelian stuff. I think this will get to the point. It is the essence of formal or psychological idealism to regard a distinction of the kind here represented, meaning universal in particular, or ego and thing in itself, as being just distinct aspects of my subjective viewpoint, and not to regard them in their turn as objectively posited. That's what I heard when you said ontologize it, Wes. Mm-hmm. In the positing of opposites as cognition of appearance, right, but to allow that formal identity to appear to be the main thing. This sort of idealism can no more cognize the appearance of the absolute, capital A, in its truth, than it can cognize the absolute identity, the one being completely inseparable for the other. So again, I think you're absolutely right. Hegel doesn't have a problem with positing with the idea of an absolute or the intellectus archetypus or a unity of quote unquote opposites in reason, right? It's just, he believes that it's not given subjectively in the way that Kant thinks, that it's given objectively and thus is approachable, presumably with, you know, a dialectic. And, you know, the question is, I don't think his characterization of Kant is wildly out of line, and he may very well be, Kant himself admits, yeah, I can't get to where I want to go, so to speak, with the structure that I put forward. But, you know, Hegel can't just say, yeah, I think it's objectively given and we can get to it, just because Kant says we can't.
Yeah. So there's a way in which in this section, right, Hegel's claiming that Kant makes his principles subjective and then only, right, the concepts in a way are formally identical to what we find in the appearance, in the object as an appearance. So you just get these two distinct aspects of a subjective viewpoint when what Hegel wants is, right, so the appearances are really just staying within subjectivity and the subject-object relation is kind of happening inside. And then the other subject-object relationship, which is with things in themselves, is just incomprehensible. So Hegel wants to get outside of that to the things in themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. What I was trying to say is I think that characterization, that's all right. The question is, how does Hegel think we can do this? Does he give us the move here in the next 10 pages after this when he starts talking about reason?
Yeah. Just saying that reason, the essence of reason for Hegel is just to posit the identity of seemingly disparate things. Sounds wild. Like, you're just going to throw that out there?
I think the general idea is that if they didn't come from the same place, they would never be reconcilable, as vague as it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what he means by rational cognition. This is why he doesn't think Kant goes far enough. And 77, he says, just in the middle paragraph, the obvious conclusion, however, is that an intellect which has cognizance only of appearances and of nothing in itself is itself only appearance and is nothing in itself. But on the contrary, Kant regards discursive intellect with this sort of cognition as an in itself and absolute. Cognition of appearances is dogmatically regarded as the only kind of cognition there is, and rational cognition is denied. If the forms through which the object exists are nothing in themselves, they must also be nothing in themselves for cognitive reason. Yet Kant never seems to have had the slightest doubt that the intellect is the absolute of the human spirit. The intellect for him is the absolute, immovable, insuperable finitude of human reason. So
the intellect being the understanding again, just so we understand that, yeah, where the concepts come from.
Yes. And at some level, Hegel, I mean, to me, again, Hegel seems to be just pointing to Kant as, you had the idea, you just didn't want to go as far as you ought to, which is saying that human beings have rational cognition, that they can ultimately hold these things themselves and have access to the thing in itself.
Yeah. There's a place on page 84. He says, reason appears pure only in its negative aspect as suspension of reflection. That's the empty unity of judgment and the intellect, I guess, or whatever words we want to use. It does not emerge in its own proper shape. He says, you would think that this negative aspect would be sufficient to keep practical reason from infinite progress, at least, there's antinomy and so on and so forth. He says, okay, forget that part about practical reason. So he basically says, thus reason is crushed completely, intellect and finitude are quite properly exultant over the decreeing of their own absolute status. Thereafter, finitude as the very highest abstraction of subjectivity or of conscious finitude establishes itself also in a positive form in which it's called practical reason. So Hegel believes that there is a positive appearance, so to speak. Reason appears in its positive aspect where it has a concept or an idea of the absolute, which is not somehow born out of an abstraction from this finite consciousness. So in other words, if I think back to phenomenology of spirit, capital R reason for Hegel is not capital R reason for Kant, in the sense that Hegel does not think that reason is essentially a product of subjective intellect. And if we think back to the way he talks about reason and spirit and consciousness in the phenomenology of spirit, it is not subjective at all. But I don't know that this is an argument.
Well, reason for Kant is not subjective either, right? But that's why it needs to be tamed. Reason for Kant. So it's the understanding is, it's like our everyday concept of reason. Kant breaks into reason capital R and the understanding, which is what is called the intellect in this paper. And only the latter. So on Hegel's analysis, intellect slash understanding is reason. That's really the only concept of reason that Kant has. Whereas Kant himself says, no, you know, reason is the thing that people have been using to make these bad metaphysical arguments throughout. It's just that reason is something that tries to cover the entirety of the possible objects of predication when actually it should just restrain itself to its proper bounds. So it is an overweening thing for both of them. It's just Hegel is okay with it being overweening and Kant is not. Am I understanding right, Wes, the distinction between understanding and reason?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
That's the part of the first critique I did not get back to. Yeah.
Yeah, for reason, right? Reason for Kant is the domain of the ideas that are unknowable, the idea of God, for instance. And they determine regulative principles, like we have to think of nature as unified and organized for the sake of inquiry, and we have to think of ourselves as free, right? This is in Hegel's directly referencing that idea here. We can't know that we're metaphysically free. And we know in the realm of appearances, we're determined. This is why Hegel's talking about the antinomies here. And we get this weird split, this weird dichotomy where Kant thinks, well, they could be actually compatible. We can't know how, but in the things in themselves, there could be a compatible between being completely determined as empirical beings where I don't have any freedom, but then in some weird way being free in a metaphysical or at the noumenal level as a thing in itself. So reason, we can think certain ideas, but we can't know them. We can't know God, which is the main complaint of this whole book. And Hegel wants to say, actually, these ideas, that's where it's at. That's the substance of philosophy. And we have to be able to know them, including God. And that, so that for Hegel is proper reason. The reason that Kant uses is just subjugated to the understanding. Understanding does all the work, can have all the knowledge, all the scientific empirical knowledge. And reason is just this kind of pauper, this outcast who says, oh, well, I can pretend these things exist because I need to think of myself as a potentially ethical being, but I can't know them.
So would we say that Kant is trying to save science from Hume because of doubting causality and provide a way to rescue that and maybe also separate it from God so that you can make it less threatening to ecclesiastical powers that be? And Hegel wants to save God from Kant.
Kant has put God in the corner. And Hegel's saying, no one puts baby in a corner.
Yeah.
Sorry.
On 82, Hegel says that for Kant, reason can't even produce ideas. He says the word idea is dragged up out of Plato right? Virtue and beauty are recognized as ideas, but, you know, so it's very contemptuous. Reason should be productive. It should be the productive imagination, what Kant calls the productive imagination. That is what reason is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's not saving God. Maybe it's saving philosophy. Hegel has to save philosophy from Kant.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the Hegelian criticism is the only concept of reason that Kant can give is the empty unity of the copula between the intuition and the understanding, the is, the predication. It's just the structure that holds all those things together. And that richer conception that Kant thinks he has, but that he can't know anything about, Hegel says, you don't even have that conception. Like, you can't even get there from where you are. So it's not even just that about you don't know it. It's because you're locked into that subjective. There's a point here also that I wanted to get to. This is page 89, because I feel like this is another criticism, but I couldn't quite tease it out. He says, Kant has simply no ground except experience and empirical psychology for holding that the human cognitive faculty essentially consists in the way it appears. In other words, like our consciousness given to us as an intuition in some way, but namely in this process from the universal to the particular, back again from the particular to the universal. Yet he himself thinks an intuitive intellect and is led to it as an absolutely necessary idea. So it is he himself who establishes the opposite experience, the experience of thinking a non-discursive intellect. And it sounds like he's saying that Kant's contradicting himself here, that all we can do is think discursively, and yet I had a thought of non-discursiveness or of a non-discursive intellect, which sounds like a contradiction.
Yeah, the question is, why do we start from this Cartesian standpoint and pretend that the internal structure of cognition is just the way things are, right? Kant is doing introspection, saying, okay, we have these concepts, and then there's the manifold. I mean, he's doing a lot of theory there, but he's working from internal reflection. So this is what Hegel calls the dogmatic subject, right? Why do we make that? This is Kant's Copernican revolution, put the self at the center, right? Rather than treating the objects as the center. And Hegel says, you know, what licenses you to do that? And why isn't that just an appearance? Why couldn't cognitive reality be something different? And hey, look, you yourself acknowledge cognitive reality could be different because of this archetypal intuitive intellect. You yourself saw that possibility. How do you know that that's not the way it really is for us? Or that we're not at least participating in that, if that's God's intellect?
What's the Kantian response to that?
I think these guys can point to a lot of problems in Kant that don't have a great response, like things in themselves and how we relate to them and how it is that some of the categories like unity seem like they must apply to things in themselves. It all falls apart. The categories have to apply to a mind-independent reality in some way in order to really make sense of the system. And once you do that, it all starts to fall apart. There can't be this strict divide between appearances in the mind to which the categories are subject, and then this unthinkable reality outside of us. We have to be able to think that reality. I think that's Hegel's main point, and I think he's right about that, whether you buy this like intuitive synthetic imagination that makes the given, you know, that that posits the data along with the concept, whatever. But I don't see how you respond at all. This is why I became kind of disenchanted with Kant, you know, reading Aristotle. I'm like, wait a minute. Aristotle has a point. It's all in that law of non-contradiction section. It doesn't make sense to think that you can just, that the world in itself is completely indeterminate, and yet we could have determinate cognition. Even before we get to the question of, well, why is this like entity subjectivity with the determinate cognition floating in this indeterminate sea of being and then turning it into something? How does that make sense? Isn't subjectivity part of being? That's a whole another argument.
So I kept thinking here about domain-specific ontology. That was something we read 200 episodes ago, the Rudolf Carnap paper, Empiricism, Semantics, and Ontology, episode 191. So the idea there was, don't just ask what is there. Ask for whatever language game you're playing, for whatever enterprise you're engaged in, what entities do we have to posit? So if you ask, are there really electrons? that question makes no sense. It's just like within the context of this explanatory theory, do you need electrons? So Kant is sort of the first version of that, that we have, if you ask, is there causality or even just is there this dog? Well, within the world of experience, yes, of course, we can objectively prove it. But when we go outside that, then we don't know. But the question is, can you really maintain that strict fence when you say things like, well, for this, you know, me to perceive a dog, there has to be the transcendental ego, which is because it's called transcendental because it's not something directly experienced. It is a structure that makes experience possible. Okay, so you've just posited that there is a transcendental ego. So you've said there is an individual thing that exists.
Yeah, I mean, Kant doesn't simpliciter. Say that.
Well, that's right. This is Hegel's response to Kant.
Kant denies it exists, but yeah, Hegel says, well, you have to say it exists.
Yeah. So even say it exists for Kant would have to be, well, exists within this domain. Even the word exists doesn't really make sense.
It exists as a formal structure, as a formal unity, my capacity to say my thoughts belong to me.
So that's the question. Is Kant wrong to insist that, I'm not really saying that it exists. I'm just saying that there is this structure. But I'm not making any existence claims about things in themselves at all because we're not able to make those. And Hegel says, you just did, right? You said there is this synthesis. You said there's this imagination that's performing the synthesis. You said there is this transcendental ego. You are positing things in themselves. So why don't you just go with that and say that you do know things about the things in themselves? And there we go. Now we've started on real philosophy and not this shrunken thing that you have made philosophy into, Kant. I noticed on page 90 of our Faith and Knowledge, there's a footnote that actually chastises Hegel. So I thought this seems like worth looking in. Page 89 to 90 is where it really dives into Hegel's take on the part of Kant that we actually read this time. This is a lot of text here.
You're going to read from 90?
Or the 89, there's this long paragraph. The idea occurs to Kant here only as a thought. Notwithstanding, it is admitted necessity, reality must not be predicated of it. On the contrary, once and for all, accept the fact that the universal and particular are inevitably and necessarily distinct. This is a quote from Kant. The intellect is for concepts, sensuous intuition for objects. They are two entirely heterogeneous parts of cognition. The idea is strictly necessary and is yet problematic. In respect of our cognitive faculty, nothing is to be acknowledged save the way it appears in its exercise, as Kant calls it, in which possibility and actuality are distinguished. So the idea here is like the idea of, you know, the regulative, the intellect that has only the God's intellect thing, right? There's a number of regulative ideas that enter into our cognition.
The idea is of God or freedom, and it plays a regulative role because I must, for practical purposes, think of freedom as existing, for example. I regulate my behavior based on that idea without saying, well, it must metaphysically exist. I act as if it exists. Kant uses this as if language all the time. But go ahead.
This is its appearance for Kant is an absolute essence. It is the in itself of cognition, as if it were not also an exercise of the cognitive faculty when it conceives and knows that an intellect for which possibility and actuality are not sundered, in which universal and particular are one, and whose spontaneity is at the same time intuitive, is a necessary idea. Kant simply has no ground except experience in empirical psychology for holding that the human cognitive faculty essentially consists in the way it appears, namely in the process from the universal to the particular or back again from the particular to the universal. Yet he himself thinks an intuitive intellect and is led to it as an absolutely necessary idea. So it is he himself who establishes the opposite experience, the experience of thinking a non-discursive intellect. He himself shows that his cognitive faculty is aware not only of the appearance and of the separation of the possible and the actual in it, but also of reason and the in itself. Kant has here before him both the idea of reason in which possibility and actuality are absolutely identical and its appearance as cognitive faculty wherein they are separated. In the experience of his thinking, he finds both thoughts. However, in choosing between the two, his nature despised the necessity of thinking the rational, of thinking an intuitive spontaneity, and decided without reservation for appearance. And so that's where that footnote comes in that says, hey, you know what? Careful reading of sections 76 and 77 of the Critique of Judgment is required for the assessment of Hegel's critique of Kant's position with respect to the unarchetypal intellect. Note the quite un-Kantian ease with which Hegel, A, proceeds from conceiving, thinking, to knowing, and B, implies that the experience of thinking is a necessary idea is an experience of the object of that idea.
Yeah, I kind of agree with the footnote.
Yeah.
Kant saying, well, we have to think of the possibility of an intuitive godlike understanding, but we can't just say it necessarily exists. And Hegel's like, well, if you think it exists, it must exist. And by the way, he's the reason why underneath all of this is his love of the ontological argument. If we can think of God, then God must exist. He's really attached to this idea that if we can think of an archetypal intellectual intuition, then at least, I mean, the way he's putting it here is like, it's an arbitrary choice. Do you want to choose the limited understanding of the empirical, or do you want to choose this possibility of a non-discursive intellect? And he's saying Kant has no good reason to just choose one or the other. So why not choose the good one? Why not choose the one that allows us to do metaphysics?
And now a word from our sponsor, Nord Security. Let's be honest. Most of the work your team does today happens inside a browser. Email, project tools, file sharing, customer platforms. It's all software as a service, all browser-based all day long. And that's exactly where the threats are moving to. Phishing, shadow IT, data leaks happening right inside live sessions and web apps. Your traditional security tools weren't built for that world. They were built for a different one. That's why NordLayer launched something new. NordLayer Browser, a business browser built specifically for how modern work actually happens. It gives your IT team real visibility and control directly at the source, inside the browser itself, without adding complexity or slowing anyone down. It's simple to deploy, easy to manage, and because it's a browser, your team already knows how to use it from day one. NordLayer Browser was built with small to medium-sized businesses in mind. You get the advanced security features that used to be reserved for big enterprise budgets without the cost, the heavy tooling, or the training headaches that come with them. The result? You reduce security risk across your SaaS workflows. You cut the operational burden of legacy security tools. You improve compliance and visibility, and your team barely notices a thing, which, honestly, is exactly what you want. If your team lives in the browser, your security should too. Don't get caught running yesterday's security on today's web. Check it out at nordlayer.com/browser. That's nordlayer.com/browser. This year, I made the decision that if I'm going to invest in how I feel, I should actually know what's going on inside. And that shift started when I realized I was already tracking a lot. Workouts, sleep, nutrition, but none of that tells you what's happening at the cellular level. That's stuff that you can't see or feel on any given day. I wanted a real data-informed baseline on the overall state of my body. That's why I got a function scan. Function's advanced MRI scans screen for signs of hundreds of potential conditions across up to 14 organs, including early signs of cancer, before you might feel a thing. They use FDA-cleared AI image enhancement, no ionizing radiation, and every scan is reviewed by board-certified radiologists. This is about finding what could otherwise go unnoticed while there's still time to do something about it. Combined with Function's over 160 lab tests, it's a powerful way to get a more comprehensive view of what's actually happening inside your body, with personalized protocols to help make sense of all of it. Your labs, your scans, your data. Because the goal was never to live longer in a hospital, it's to live well for 100 healthy years. Get ahead of what you can't feel yet. Join at functionhealth.com/PEL or use gift code PEL25. For a $25 credit towards your membership. And even more, you can add scans to your Function membership and get up to a $200 credit towards your scan.
On this podcast, we all have our strengths and we complement each other. Off the air, it's the same thing. We each contribute something different to keep PEL rolling along. If you're starting a new endeavor, you might feel like you need some partners with strengths that complement yours. Maybe those people are in your life and can help. Maybe not. In either case, you want the one game-changing business partner with you at all times, Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. From household names like Thrive Cosmetics and Aviator Nation to brands just getting started. As a partner, Shopify brings design. Hundreds of ready-to-use templates that help you build beautiful online store that matches your brand style. Efficiency. Helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, enhance your product photography, manage inventory, shipping, returns, and more. Marketing. Easy to run email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are strolling or scrolling. And help. The always around 24/7 support. We at PEL didn't go it alone, and you don't have to either. Pick the one partner guaranteed to make your life easier and your business operations smoother. Shopify. Start your own business, hey, or maybe even a podcast, today with the industry's best partner, Shopify, and start hearing. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/PEL. Go to shopify.com/PEL. That's shopify.com/PEL. Man, this is interesting. Okay. Thanks for bringing this up. So, you know, if we go back to the earlier part of that quote, in respect to the cognitive faculty, nothing is to be acknowledged save the way it appears in its exercise, which in which possibility and actuality are distinguished. Cognition is aware not only of the appearance and of the separation of the possible and actual in it, but also of reason and the in itself. Kant has here before him both the idea of a reason in which possibility and actuality are absolutely identical and its appearance as a cognitive faculty when they are separated. So it sounds like Hegel's move here is not to say he has an idea, he has two ideas of reason. One he's claiming is possible, one he's claiming is actual.
Can I stop you right there? I mean, the possible and the actual, the possible is the domain of concepts. The actual is the contingent given, right? That's the work that Kant does at the beginning of the sections we read. For a non-discursive intellect, those two collapse because, right, we said he's not a modal realist. There is no such thing as possibility except to a finite understanding. So the particulars necessarily flow from the idea. The idea produces its own particulars just by virtue of being the idea, possibility and actuality collapse. It gives itself the actual. It doesn't wait on some external sensuous given for the actual. Intuition produces what it intuits.
Right. So I'm trying to take this part right here where Hegel is saying Kant has these two ideas of reason, the finite reason and the archetypal reason. In the archetypal reason, actuality and possibility are identical, right? It's pure, it's intuition combined with understanding. And in the subjective reason, it's intuition and understanding separated. Now,
the understanding, yeah.
Yeah. What I'm trying to think through here is, so like you said, we're kind of making this claim that Hegel's saying, you know, he has the idea, he already has the idea. And he just chooses the limited form instead of the, and why not just, you know, choose the other one? And we're saying maybe he's collapsing this. He's making that ontological argument. If you think it, then it's real kind of thing. But what it sounds like here to me is, I'm not sure if that's what's happening or not. That's why, what it sounds like to me is he's saying the Kantian explanation of, yeah, I have an idea of the intellectual archetype. I have an idea of human consciousness or human intellect. And Kant would say, but I have intuition. I have actual intuitions, concrete, particular, you know, appearances that validate the subjective intellect, this idea I have of a reason that's intellect and understanding separated. Yeah, I have this idea of the intellect where they're not separated, where they're unified and identical, but I don't have any content. There's no intuition. I don't have, you know, it's just like a unicorn. I have an idea. I just don't have any, there's no intuition that I have of that particular thing. And the question is, from my perspective, would that even be possible from the perspective of a separated, an intellect where intuition and understanding is separated? Could you have an intuition that somehow gave content to an idea of an intellect where they're not separated? And of course, Kant says no. So then what does it mean to have that?
It's a crazy, I think, can I sum up what you're saying? Kind of a crazy idea. So of course, Kant would reject it. It's we know we don't produce our own given. We know that for a fact. We're not making the world with our minds. Understanding and sensibility are certainly separate for us. Concept in particular are certainly separate for us. Kant is not wrong about that. And we can't even conceive. I mean, I think we'd all have to admit that this being in whom intuition and understanding is combined, that archetypal intellect is not conceivable for us. I don't see how Hegel can deny it. But even if we can have the idea of it, or maybe even if we could know it, that doesn't mean that we can do the same thing as it. That's a whole extra step. If doing metaphysics and knowing the things themselves requires that we have this godlike intellect, that is even crazier, unless we can get to some vision of reality in which reflective judgment, right, that the thing that we can do with aesthetics and teleology is somehow participating or connecting us to that intuitive intellect that creates the world. Do you see what I'm saying? Hegel needs some extra steps here even to make sense of his picture, but he's acting like it's so obvious. So obvious, Kant.
Yeah, I can get a criticism here of Kant where you're saying, yeah, you've rigged the game. Like, you've basically said, like, I have this idea that I can never cash out an experience because the way I've structured the mechanisms of experience just obviate it. There's no way. And I can see philosophically how that's a terribly unsatisfying kind of thing. But I feel like what Hegel needs to say here to give this a little more, to give his criticism a little more substance, is to say something like, either that Kant makes that move, somehow regulative ideas which are possible and not actual have some kind of status that speaks to the structure of consciousness in such a way that the way Kant, you know, has characterized it is wrong. Or if you want to stay within the Kantian framework and use a different type of terminology, Hegel has to say, hey, these ideas can get content. They just don't get it from sensuous intuition. Like, there are ways to provide intuitive content to ideas beyond sensuous intuition, or there's a way to at least provide content to this particular idea without referring to sensuous intuition. I don't know if that's something Hegel would want to do, but there, he has to do more here, I think, in his criticism.
So he goes farther on the next page, but yeah, he'll spell out our capacity for reflective judgment.
When Hegel, when he says that, Kant, you conceived of this already there, and you just, I mean, I've characterized it, like, you know, he just accuses Kant of being cowardly for not accepting the fact that, yeah, well, you've already thought of the ability of us to conceive of the unity of the particular and the universal. And so, because you've been able to conceive of it, why don't you do the thing and just accept that it actually is? And it made me just, when it was brought up again, just made me wonder why Hegel, in that kind of claim, isn't just open to the simple criticism that if I can conceive of dragons, therefore they must exist, or any other kind of other criticism that you would make of this, the notion that we can conceive of something doesn't mean that it exists, which is partly why Kant is in the situation he is, right? That he's trying to deal with the skepticism of someone like Hume.
It's not that every conceivable thing has to exist, just the conception of an infinite being. But I think we should get to page 91.
Well, but there's a lot of, right, any of the regulative ideas, and the distinction that the editors in that footnote I read were pointing out was that thinking an idea and thinking the object of that idea are not the same thing, right? So we have to think that the world is organized. And so beyond what the understanding built, right, understanding everything is going to be causal, but we were saying that this greater harmony is not actually, you couldn't get that just from the categories of the understanding. It has to be a regulative idea of reason. So there's something in the supersensible realm that grounds this idea of harmony between all the different physical laws. But just the fact that I'm thinking that thought doesn't mean that I understand what it is that is doing the harmonizing. I'm not thinking of God. I'm just thinking of, so this is why, Dylan, earlier in this discussion, you were resisting my importing God into this, because Kant wants to be very clear of exactly what is necessary to be thought. And these are not productive ideas. It does not then, well, once I'm thinking of God, then I know he's the best possible creature and that he has all these, you know, that's the productive idea. No, it's just a regulative idea that when we're doing science, you have to assume this level of organization. But then, you know, of course, there are different purposes that we have within this reason, within the religion, within the bounds of reason alone, this book, that are even explicitly about the afterlife, right? We have to assume, just because of our human constitution, that since there's no justice in this world, right, we have the problem of evil, that there must be an afterlife in which justice is done. So that is a regulative idea. And Kant still would want to make, okay, but I don't know heaven. I can't start then theorizing about heaven, even though I've said there has to be something that would serve the purpose that traditional religion uses heaven and hell for. But you could see, especially with that example, why Hegel would just be impatient and say, dude, you've just posited heaven and hell are necessary. Dragons are not necessary, but God and heaven and hell and all these things are actually necessary for us to live our lives. So just posit that they exist. Just do philosophy about them.
Well, there's more to this argument, right? We've stopped along the way here, but he's going to go on to say that Kant has given us the cognitive tools to move beyond this position where these things are simply unknowable, and that is in the beautiful. So at the bottom of page 91, on to 92, he says, Kant himself recognized in the beautiful an intuition other than the sensuous. So we caught Kant red-handed, is that the phrase? I think dementia is setting in. We've caught him with his hand in the cookie jar. I don't know yep. The way to put it. He says there is an intuition other than the sensuous. So, you know, why not take that avenue? He characterized the substratum of nature as intelligible, recognized it to be rational and identical with all reason, and knew that the cognition in which concept and intuition are separated was subjective finite cognition, a merely phenomenal cognition, right? Nonetheless, where there the matter must rest for Kant. We must absolutely not go beyond finite cognition. This is sarcasm, right? This is not him saying this. Although the cognitive faculty is capable of thinking the idea and the rational, it simply must not employ it as a cognitive standard. Do you guys like this tone?
I do. I think you're getting Hegel right on at that point.
This is clarify things. It must regard itself as absolutely only when it knows the organic and itself finitely, phenomenally. So back to Hegel's voice. The truly speculative aspect of Kant's philosophy can only consist in the idea being thought and expressed so definitely, and the pursuit of this side of his philosophy is the only interesting aspect of it. What a douche, man. He would never have thought of any of this stuff without Kant. They are totally pivoting off of Kant. Anyway, this makes it all the harder to see the rational being muddled up again, and not just that, but to see the highest idea corrupted with full consciousness, while reflection and finite cognition are exalted above. He's going to go on to say, basically, that the idea of a productive imagination that Kant has within cognition can be, it doesn't need to just be subjective. Like I said, we can actually ontologize it. And the window into the possibility that it's ontological is aesthetic intuition, which is non-sensuous. It's weird because it's sensuous and we need sensuous appearances to do aesthetic intuition. But aesthetic intuition itself is not about putting particulars under concepts, putting sensuous beings under concepts. It's digging down into some more fundamental structure in those things.
Yeah, so that in a way makes sense, right? Especially to the extent that the aesthetic is part of reason, and it becomes the avenue by which we are able to unify the particular and the universal through aesthetic reason.
Yeah. 93, but if this productive imagination is merely a property of the subject, of man and his intellect, it abandons of itself its place in the middle, which alone makes it what it is and becomes subjective. The middle, right, has to be this term in between subject and object that both kind of emerge out of. That's where imagination actually belongs.
Yep. That should be the in itself, or the thing in itself. I got distracted for a second because I was trying to think how we could make ontologize it into a meme. You know, let's work up some graphics.
Ontologize this.
Oh, what else? So I guess the Hegel ends this whole thing by talking about Fichte, right, who is a very loyal Kantian in some ways, but he took Hegel's move of not keeping everything to its proper domain, right? So he felt okay making more grandiose metaphysical statements. So I think, you know, Hegel is not breaking new ground here. He's already seen in Fichte here, which then he's going to go on to criticize in a separate chapter. Again, Kant was really on to something. If you read Kant correctly, which Kant did not do himself, then you should actually go the direction of Hegel. And of course, Hegel is going to not, you know, he sees his opponents as stepping stones in his phenomenological dialectic progress. So it is absolutely essential that we, you know, study Kant, that we study Fichte, that we make these steps, because only then will it be really clear, right? If you just came up with this idea of God that Hegel seems to have just out of the air, well, then it does sound like really some crummy use of the ontological argument from philosophers long ago. No. You have to follow the Kantian trail, and only then will you see exactly how dynamic and powerful and destined. We were being Hegelians all along. We just didn't even know it. We were going that direction.
I mean, he explicitly, by the way, we're not just reading the ontological argument, 94 into it, 94, 95, he explicitly mentions that. That's why he wants to go from the idea to, right, of what for Kant is unknowable to something that for reason actually is knowable and exists, must exist.
Do we want to read, is there a quote there we want to read?
Sure. I'll just start. So at the bottom of 94, the first full paragraph, if we remove from the practical faith of the Kantian philosophy some of the popular and unphilosophical garments in which it is decked, we shall find nothing else expressed in it but the idea that reason does have absolute reality, that in this idea, the antithesis of freedom and necessity is completely suspended, that infinite thought is at the same time absolute reality, or in short, that we shall find the absolute identity of thought and being. We are here thinking only of Kant's doctrine of faith in God. For this, his account of immortality has nothing original in it to make it worthy of philosophical attention. Gotta love this. All right, here's the ontological argument. This idea of the absolute identity of thought and being is the very one which the ontological proof and all true philosophy recognize as the sole and primary idea, as well as the only true and philosophical one. Where does he mention the bad? Kant only disproves the bad one.
That's way earlier. Yeah, we quoted that in our last episode.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, it does sound a lot like, right, if the idea of the infinite being and the intuitive archetypal intellect, where intuition and understanding converges, is thinkable, then it's knowable and necessary and exists and all that.
Yeah, so to generalize, I mean, he spends a little time in this essay talking about some of Kant's antinomies, which we didn't explicitly review. So I was, you know, having a hard time remembering how he talks about mathematics and, you know, is there infinity? Is there not infinity? Something like that. But in general, like Kant just presents these things as within the realm of experience, you know, reason that tries to outrun experience gives conflicting answers. And the one that I always like to bring up is, you know, does the universe have a beginning? Is there a first cause? Or does the trail of causality run infinitely? Like both of them, you can kind of argue for within the realm of experience, and, you know, everything is causal, everything. But Kant just leaves it as, okay, well, there's some resolution to this in the supersensible world that we can't make sense of. And Hegel just finds that totally intolerable.
Yeah. So there's these mathematical antinomies, which are about the, you know, is the world have a beginning in time and limited in space, or is it infinite in both directions? And, you know, is every composite substance made of simples? And those, you know, he says that both, basically both sides of the antinomies are false. And because they share the false presupposition that the world of appearance is a thing in itself. But on the other side, these dynamic antinomies, you know, is where you know, is there causality through freedom? No, everything is determined. Is there a necessary being and cause of the world? No, God doesn't exist. He says, in a sense, both can be true. That's the solution to the third and fourth antinomies, the dynamical antinomies. Both sides can be true. So because natural causation governs the phenomenal world, freedom and necessity could conceivably exist outside of it. Hegel hates this split.
Yeah.
I think that offends him the most.
Yeah. In laying out these antinomies and saying, well, we can't just be comfortable with contradiction. There has to be a resolution in the supersensible. Hegel says, hey, look, you've just started by saying there has to be resolution in the supersensible. You've just started doing real philosophy. So do that. Why not just say there is a realm in which freedom and determinism are reconciled? Not that, well, there could be one. I don't know. It's we as finite beings of the type that we are have to think of it, but we can't know it for sure. Like, stop. That scruple makes no sense.
Yeah, this idea where the understanding and the intuition could somehow be combined in an archetype, that unfolds like the ontological version of that, which is that subject and object, universal in particular, they could be combined in the primordial ooze and then come out of it, which allows us to get beyond all of these problems of trying to combine these two disparate things, like creating this radical split between subjectivity and the world, and then saying, how do we get them back together? What if they started together?
All right. Any closing thoughts?
Sort of newfound respect for Kant. I still don't have the urge to go dive into the Critique of Pure Reason, but
it's so simple after Hegel. It's just like, it's like butter. It's like butter.
But no, I love having my biases against philosophers like stripped from me. So yay.
I've already labeled a couple parts of the Critique of Pure Reason that I want Wes and I to do in close reads. But unless I run into something truly surprising, I feel like there's other Kant. I wouldn't mind spending more time with the Critique of Judgment or other things that, you know, are just we've never read before any part of. But I feel like we have the main Kantian framework down. Yeah.
Well, I would like to do the critique. I think it's so important and there's so much that we don't fully, you know, haven't mastered. And it's a key to unlock, you know, everything that comes after from my point of view. So understanding the way it all interconnects is very gratifying, actually, and especially the apperception. We could just do one episode on the apperception and do that across Hume and Kant and then contemporary philosophers, do a topical one. It'd be so enlightening. But yeah.
Well, next time we are going to maybe two more episodes to actually finish up our treatment of Hegel's phenomenology, right? All this to remind you, this detour into Hegel on this Faith and Knowledge episode was to be able to have a better insight into what he actually has to say about faith. So it'll be interesting to see whether the general Enlightenment view of faith is actually what we see in Kant, or whether it is something I would assume kind of shallower. But yeah, consider that right where we left off in the phenomenology after the culture sections, after the Rameau's nephew relevant section, the faith section, and get through as much of the rest of the Enlightenment chapter as we can before we run out of steam. You should email us. People have been emailing us. We've been collecting your ideas. Thank you so much for them. We want more. PEL@partiallyexaminedlife.com, or just make a comment on the blog post associated with this episode, or reach out through Twitter, Facebook, etc. Thanks. Night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
The Partially Examined Life is celebrating the 250th birthday of our nation with another live show. We're back in Madison, Wisconsin on Saturday, July 11th in the afternoon. Rapper Vanilla Ice may or may not be in attendance. We would love all those in the area willing to fly in to attend. Please look to partiallyexaminedlife.com/live for details.